Chapter 13. Scotland Yard is a very small tract of land, bounded on one side by the River Thames, on the other by the gardens of Northumberland House. Abutting at one end on the bottom of Northumberland Street, at the other on the back of Whitehall Place. When this territory was first accidentally discovered by a country gentleman who lost his way in the Strand, some years ago, the original settlers were found to be a tailor, a publican, two eating housekeepers, and a fruit pie maker, and it was also found to contain a race of strong and bulky men, who repaired to the wharfs in Scotland Yard regularly every morning, about 5 or 6 o'clock, to fill heavy wagons with coal, with which they proceeded to distant places up the country, and supplied the inhabitants with fuel. When they had emptied their wagons, they again returned for a fresh supply, and this trade was continued throughout the year. As the settlers derived their subsistence from ministering to the wants of these primitive traders, the articles exposed for sale, and the places where they were sold, bore strong outward marks of being expressly adapted to their tastes and wishes. The tailor displayed in his window a Lilliputian pair of leather gaiters, and a diminutive round frock, while each doorpost was appropriately garnished with a model of a coal sack. The two eating housekeepers exhibited joints of a magnitude, and puddings of a solidity, which coal livers alone could appreciate, and the fruit pie maker displayed on his well-scrubbed window board large white compositions of flour and dripping, ornamented with pink stains, giving rich promise of the fruit within, which made their huge mouths water as they lingered past. But the choicest spot in all Scotland Yard was the old public house in the corner. Here, in a dark wainscoted room of ancient appearance, cheered by the glow of a mighty fire, and decorated with an enormous clock, whereof the face was white, and the figures black, sat the lusty coal-hivers, quaffing large draughts of Barclay's Best, and puffing forth volumes of smoke, which wreathed heavily above their heads, and involved the room in a thick dark cloud. From this apartment, might their voices be heard on the winter's night, penetrating to the very bank of the river, as they shouted out some sturdy chorus, or roared forth the burden of a popular song, dwelling upon the last few words with a strength and length of emphasis which made the very roof tremble above them. Here, too, would they tell old legends of what the Thames was in ancient times, when the patent shot manufactory wasn't built, and Waterloo Bridge had never been thought of, and then they would shake their heads with portentous looks, to the deep edification of the rising generation of heavers, who crowded round them, and wondered where all this would end, whereat the tailor would take his pipe solemnly from his mouth, and say, how that he hoped it might end well, but he very much doubted whether it would or not, and couldn't rightly tell what to make of it. A mysterious expression of opinion, delivered with a semi-prophetic air, which never failed to elicit the fullest concurrence of the assembled company. And so they would go on drinking and wondering till 10 o'clock came, and with it the tailor's wife to fetch him home, when the little party broke up, to meet again in the same room, and say and do precisely the same things, on the following evening at the same hour. About this time the barges that came up the river began to bring vague rumors to Scotland Yard of somebody in the city having been heard to say that the Lord Mayor had threatened in so many words to pull down the old London Bridge and build up a new one. At first these rumors were disregarded as idle tales, wholly destitute of foundation, for nobody in Scotland Yard doubted that, if the Lord Mayor contemplated any such dark design, he would just be clapped up in the tower for a week or two, and then killed off for high treason. By degrees, however, the reports grew stronger and more frequent, and at last a barge, laden with numerous chaldrons of the best Walsand, brought up the positive intelligence that several of the arches of the old bridge were stopped, and that preparations were actually in progress for constructing the new one. What an excitement was visible in the old tap room on that memorable night! Each man looked into his neighbor's face, pale with alarm and astonishment, and read there an echo of the sentiments which filled his own breast. The oldest Heaver present proved to demonstration that the moment the piers were removed, all the water in the Thames would run clean off, and leave a dry gully in its place. What was to become of the coal barges of the trade of Scotland Yard, of the very existence of its population? The tailor shook his head more sagely than usual, and grimly pointing to a knife on the table, bid them wait, and see what happened. He said nothing, not he, but if the Lord Mayor didn't fall a victim to popular indignation, why, he would be rather astonished, that was all. They did wait. Barge after barge arrived, and still no tidings of the assassination of the Lord Mayor. The first stone was laid. It was done by a duke, the king's brother. Years passed away, and the bridge was opened by the king himself. In course of time, the piers were removed, and when the people in Scotland Yard got up next morning in the confident expectation of being able to step over to Peddler's Acre without wetting the soles of their shoes, they found to their unspeakable astonishment that the water was just where it used to be. A result so different from that which they had anticipated from this first improvement produced its full effect upon the inhabitants of Scotland Yard. One of the eating house keepers began to court public opinion, and to look for customers among a new class of people. He covered his little dining tables with white cloths, and got a painter's apprentice to inscribe something about hot joints from 12 to 2, in one of the little panes of his shop window. Improvement began to march with rapid strides to the very threshold of Scotland Yard. A new market sprung up at Hungerford, and the police commissioners established their office in Whitehall Place. The traffic in Scotland Yard increased. Fresh members were added to the House of Commons, the metropolitan representatives founded a near cut, and many other foot passengers followed their example. We marked the advance of civilization, and beheld it with a sigh. The eating house keeper, who manfully resisted the innovation of tablecloths, was losing ground every day, as his opponent gained it, and a deadly feud sprung up between them. The genteel one no longer took his evening's pint in Scotland Yard, but drank gin and water at a parlor in Parliament Street. The fruit pie maker still continued to visit the old room, but he took to smoking cigars, and began to call himself a pastry cook, and to read the papers. The old heavers still assembled round the ancient fireplace, but their talk was mournful, and the loud song and the joyous shout were heard no more. And what is Scotland Yard now? How have its old customs changed? And how has the ancient simplicity of its inhabitants faded away? The old tottering public house is converted into a spacious and lofty wine vault. Apostrophe gold leaf has been used in the construction of the letters which emblazon its exterior, and the poet's art has been called into requisition, to intimate that, if you drink a certain description of ale, you must hold fast by the rail. The tailor exhibits in his window the pattern of a foreign-looking brown surtout, with silk buttons, a fur collar, and fur cuffs. He wears a stripe down the outside of each leg of his trousers. And we have detected his assistants, for he has assistants now, in the act of sitting on the shop board in the same uniform. At the other end of the little row of houses, a bootmaker has established himself in a brick box, with the additional innovation of a first floor, and here he exposes for sale boots, real Wellington boots, an article which a few years ago none of the original inhabitants had ever seen or heard of. It was but the other day that a dressmaker opened another little box in the middle of the row, and when we thought that the spirit of change could produce no alteration beyond that, a jeweler appeared, and not content with exposing gilt rings and copper bracelets out of number, put up an announcement, which still sticks in his window, that ladies' ears may be pierced within. Apostrophe the dressmaker employs a young lady who wears pockets in her apron, and the tailor informs the public that gentlemen may have their own materials made up. Amidst all this change, and restlessness, and innovation, there remains but one old man, who seems to mourn the downfall of this ancient place. He holds no converse with humankind, But, seated on a wooden bench at the angle of the wall which fronts the crossing from Whitehall Place, watches in silence the gambols of his sleek and well-fed dogs. He is the presiding genius of Scotland Yard. Years and years have rolled over his head. But, in fine weather or in foul, hot or cold, whether dry, hail, rain, or snow, he is still in his accustomed spot. Misery and want are depicted in his countenance. His form is bent by age, his head is gray with length of trial, but there he sits from day to day, brooding over the past, and thither he will continue to drag his feeble limbs, until his eyes have closed upon Scotland Yard, and upon the world together. A few years hence, and the antiquary of another generation looking into some mouldy record of the strife and passions that agitated the world in these times, may glance his eye over the pages we have just filled. And not all his knowledge of the history of the past, not all his black-letter lore, or his skill in book-collecting, not all the dry studies of a long life, or the mouldy volumes that have cost him a fortune, may help him to the whereabouts, either of Scotland Yard, or of any one of the landmarks we have mentioned in describing it. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.